All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? I want to put this out there because I think you should know our book, Waiting for the Punch, comes out in paperback next week. You can go to markmaronbook.com or click on the book link at WTFpod.com to pre-order a copy, or just get it when it comes out next Tuesday, October 16th. Waiting for the Punch in paperback. You've been waiting for the punch in paperback, so the waiting is over. See? That's what I should have done. That should have been the whole thing. There's no more waiting for the punch. You just have to wait until next Tuesday, October 16th, if you don't want to pre-order it. A lot of ways I could have handled that, but I chose the straight read, as they say in the business of broadcasting. So what's happening? What have I got to tell you? Today on the show, Kurt Vile is here. He's got a new record coming out. I like Kurt Vile. Had an opportunity to talk to him. We have common friends. His new album, Bottle In, comes out this Friday, October 12th. Get it wherever you get music. Kurt Vile puts out a lot of records, and he's got a unique thing going. He always sounds like him. The production sounds like him. The music sounds like him. His voice sounds like him. He sounds like him. That's not nothing. You don't want to listen to something and go, like, this sounds like another guy. Hey, this sounds kind of like, hey, I can hear that other guy in this guy's music. Nope. Kurt Vile sounds like Kurt Vile. And he's a Philly guy. He's like a Philly guy, but what would you call it? He's not a hard-edged Philly guy. He's the other end of the spectrum. There's a lot of type of Philly dudes, and Kurt is of the mellow breed of Philly, which is a rare breed in Philly. And I'm not saying anything negative about Philly. I don't know how many Philly meatheads really listen to this show, but maybe the softer meatheads, maybe the turkey meatheads, perhaps. I don't know, but. Philly is its own animal. It's its own place. It's its own time zone. It's its own planet, man. But Kurt comes from there, and you can hear it a little bit. But we had a nice talk. I was glad he came by. Speaking of Kurt Vile, why don't I just talk about music for a few minutes? Let's just focus in on maybe what I've been listening to. What are you listening to? What are you listening to? Anything exciting? I just got a copy. Mark Arm from Mudhoney sent me a copy of the new Mudhoney record. I believe it's called Digital Garbage. Now, Mudhoney got a lot of records out. There was a period in time where they were putting out a record every 5 minutes. And they're always good. They're always raw. They're always Stooges-ish. But uniquely Mudhoney. Nice kind of, you know, raunchy guitars. Mark scream singing. Yeah, and he sent me one. And I haven't heard of a Mudhoney record in, it feels like, years. And I got to tell you, it's a good record. I've only listened to side one, and I'm like, this is fucking Mudhoney record. Top-notch Mudhoney right here. So I've been listening to that. I listened to Kurt Vile's new record. I've been listening to, going back and listening to some Wilco, because I had to do some research. Enough said. I'm not saying anything else. Had to kind of rejigger the Wilco knob in my brain. Had to open that portal back up and play that out. Been listening to some Albert Eiler in the jazz zone. That new John Coltrane record that was never issued. That double album, man, that fucking thing is sweet. What else I've been doing? I went to see the MC5, the current lineup of the MC5. As you might know, not many are left. I think Wayne Kramer, the guitar player who I've had on the show here, he's left. There's a drummer left, but he's not playing with them regularly. But Wayne has pulled together the band. I don't know. I saw a benefit here at the Ford Theater. Wayne asked me to come. And I got to say, it was a pretty fucking amazing show. Now, I got there. There was three bands. I got there in the middle of the first band. I don't even know who it was, sadly. But the second band, holy shit. It's a band called Starcrawler, and it left a lasting impression on me. I'm not sure if it's the right one. I don't know, man. It's heavy, but it's sort of like, it's kind of punky, but kind of hard rocky. It's a trio behind a lead singer. And this woman, Arrow DeWild, man, it was raw shit, man. She just jerking around up there, jumping around, falling down. looked like she was hurting herself, and it had an effect. I mean, I'm going to go out and buy the records. I don't know if that was the way it was supposed to happen, but it was something to watch, man. It was confrontational. It was good, man. It was good. And it made a lasting impression on me. That I will tell you, the band Starcrawler. But then the MC5. So the current lineup is pretty amazing. All right. So Wayne Kramer, who has been on the show, he got in touch. He texted me, said I should come. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to come. I've never been to the Ford Theater. It's this sweet little amphitheater that's tucked away across the way from the Hollywood Bowl somewhere off Cahuenga there, and only seats about 1,200. It's like a miniature Red Rocks. It's this fucking sweet venue. I don't know why I've never been there. But why? Because I hardly ever go out to see live music. So the MC5 at this point is Wayne, the original guitar player of the MC5, Kim Thiel from Soundgarden, Brendan Canty on drums, from Fugazi, Doug Pinnick on bass, and I guess I don't know the band King's X, but that's who he's from. And this guy singing, Marcus Durant, from a band called Zen Gorilla, looked so much and sounded so much like Rob Tyner, the original guy. I mean, I don't know that they sounded a lot alike, but there's something about the way that that Marcus Durant sort of held himself up there that reminded me of footage I had seen of Rob Tyner. Now, obviously, Sonic Fred Smith has passed away, so Thiel is kind of filling that second guitar zone, but let me tell you who else was there, because it was pretty exciting. Matt Cameron from Soundgarden was the second drummer on the show I saw, and Greg Dooley came out from Afghan Whigs and sang a tune, I think just one, and Duff from Guns N' Roses came out and played guitar on a couple. But the thing that amazed me most about seeing the MC5 at this point, because a lot of times you go to stuff like that where there's not many of the original members of the band because they're old, or some of them are dead, or they're not together anymore. Or you just think that it's not going to be good, or it's going to be disappointing, or it's going to be a little sad. But I got to be honest with you, it's not like going to see Journey with the new guy. You know, it's not like going to see some band from the 70s or 80s with a few hits that you remember. I mean, the MC5 was this fucking seminal sound. It was this Detroit sound that was an amalgamation. It was a part of that Detroit momentum, and it was a defining sound of like the Stooges, of punk rock. It was just those few MC5 records. Nothing sounds like that. And there wasn't hits. There wasn't about the hits. It was about the time. It was about the insanity. It was about the chaos. It was about that sort of rendition, mid to late 60s, I guess it was, of that Detroit breakdown, man. And, you know, how are you going to capture that? You know, because Kim Thiel, you know, is a fairly compressed player. Like, you know, he's got a very specific tone. He's a great player. And he's holding up that end. But I happen to be sitting right up front, and I'm right in front of fucking Wayne. I'd moved down. My seats were way back. I went over there with my buddy Adam. So I was like almost inside the mixer. Like I was hearing what was coming out of the monitors and the amps more than I was hearing what was being, you know, broadcast or put out there through the PA. So I'm hearing Wayne. And I guess my point is that when those songs, if you honor those songs and the spirit of those songs and the heart of those songs, that MC5 stuff, I mean, it was electrifying, man. And I think that part of it was because the original guitar guy was playing it. I mean, Wayne was playing it, and he's specifically Wayne. It's amazing how tone just stays with somebody. And it's not about boxes. It's not about pedals. It's not about amps. It's about Wayne's fingers and Wayne's voice. So everybody was sort of following Wayne. And all those songs, all the fucking songs, the MC5 songs, that is what they played, sounded great. And it rocked. There was no point where you're like, well, this is a little sad, this is a little weird, or it's too bad that the rest of them aren't here. It was just right on the fucking money. And they even did some loopy-ass, hardcore, hippie art, you know, jazz experimental jamming. And that was even okay. Didn't go on too long. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like seeing a Dead show and it was space and it was time to take a bathroom break. Then a few horns came out at some point. I don't know. I guess what I was sort of impressed with was just that Kramer's spirit You know, and he does a lot of great stuff for Jail Guitar Doors. It's his foundation for, you know, getting musical instruments into the prison system. And I think some of the horn players were ex-cons, and there was a guy who was who came and said a few words before the show who was out of prison. It's very helpful. But there's something about Wayne's spirit that still comes through that guitar. I mean, Wayne's in his 60s, man, and he's and I'm using the word man a lot because I guess I'm talking about the MC5, man. But, you know, he's doing, if you've seen old footage of the MC5, him swinging that guitar up and jumping around, it's like, you know, little old Wayne Kramer is still swinging that guitar up and playing it straight up and like he's all in. And it was electrifying. And I'm not saying this is some weird baby boomer guy who remembers the MC5. I'm 55. I was not conscious. I didn't come to the MC5 till the last decade or so. And I just got to say, maybe it's the infusion of all that other amazing talent on stage, amazing musicians who were there to honor that music, but it's very specific. I had a great time. Wasn't too long. Nothing dragged on. You know, it was tight. They went from one song to the other. No dicking around. And at the end, you're like, fuck yeah, no encores. Got to respect no encore on some level. I did. I don't know if they ran out of time or if it's an actual intention, but I was like, no, that was the show. That was the show. Why fuck with us? Why hold out a couple just because it's the form that's the acceptable way to play a concert? They're done. They're done. Lights up. Kurt Vile is here, and he's a younger man than I, and I like talking to these youngsters about their music, these kids about their musical stylings. But he's a friend of my friend Tom Sharpwings. Oh, shit. Wait a minute. Before I forget, I want to bring this up again. I am going to be hosting an event called Across the Great Divide. It's a benefit concert for the Americana Music Association and the Blues Foundation. It's going to be John Prine, Bob Weir, Lucinda Williams, Leanne Womack, Doyle Bramhall II, Shamika Copeland, Larkin Poe, Joe Louis Walker, Tash Neal. And I think just announced the special guest, Slash, is going to be there. And if my picking finger is good, Jimmy Vivino is the musical director, maybe I will play a song. Is that precocious of me to even think that I may play a tune with the band on a night like that? Hey, man, blues is simple. Blues is simple. It's about the feel. It's about the tone. Man, Wayne Kramer shot that MC5 tone right through that Stratocaster into my brain the other night. But I'm supposed to be setting up Kurt Vile here. But this is all music related, and I don't know why I'm talking like a early 70s jacked up jock. And I mean DJ when I say that. So let's talk about Kurt Vile. He has many records out, and I started getting them a few years ago. And like I said earlier, You drop that needle in the groove, and it's clearly Kurt Vile, and that's a beautiful thing. His new record, Bottle In, comes out this Friday, October 12th, and this is me talking to Philly's own Kurt Vile. So wait, so your wife is full on...
She goes to school to be an or takes classes to be an Ayurvedic consultant.
Oh, really?
Yes, really.
So that's her trip to be.
Well, she's smart.
Yeah.
She was pre-med, you know. Mm-hmm. She went to Dartmouth, and then she just changed it all. Now, then she's taught.
She's like, fuck Western medicine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm going the other way.
Well, yeah. Obviously, it's not. You don't. Sometimes you really do need it.
Of course.
But yeah. I mean, it's just like anything else. It's like, see those commercials.
Which ones?
I don't know, advertising any medicine under the sun. And they're like,
and the side effects are just relentless.
Yeah.
You're like, why would I take that? It sounds like that I'm going to have a whole new set of problems. Maybe.
Probably. Definitely.
Maybe. I don't know. You know, like, it's weird. I take blood cholesterol medicine. And I don't know. You know, it's weird that it's our natural aversion to be like, oh, fuck that. Fuck medicine. No one wants to be sick, you know?
Yeah,
but
no.
Sometimes you're sort of like, well, I guess I got to take it. But there are side effects, but I haven't gotten it yet. Who knows? How long is life really, Kurt?
I don't know. How old are you?
54.
I'm right behind you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's sort of like, well, what if down the line there are side effects? I'm like, well, I'll risk it. Yeah,
I was more talking about those blatantly.
Which ones? Yeah.
I don't know. That's any late night commercial. Sure. Where these new medicines all the time. Like, that is not.
The jellyfish one. You remember the one that's like.
If you get to with that side of thoughts, like. Oh, yeah, contact those. Blah. If your stomach expands, yeah. fills with blueberry, like Willy Wonka.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you turn into a giant blueberry, stop taking immediately.
Yeah,
something's wrong. Like I keep the one I can't get out of my head, but I can't remember what medicine is the ones like from a thing found in jellyfish. It's from the brain for the memory, and I always think that's such a weird angle. Like why. With jellyfish, it's found in jellyfish. Why would that be appealing? But it is sort of, isn't it? That must be deep shit if it's in jellyfish.
Yeah.
So do you live out here or you don't?
No, I live in Philly. I'm from Philly and I live there still.
Oh, really? Someone told me you had a place out here. You don't, huh?
I come out a lot, but I don't have a place.
No? There.
Nope.
Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I like Philly.
Yeah.
I do. Like, I don't know it as well as I should, but, like, the times I've gone and hung out there and the people I know from there, they're good people. They got an edge to them.
Yeah.
You don't...
Definitely.
You don't strike me as, like, the Philly kind of fuck you Philly guy.
Oh, but I can be.
Yeah, it's in you?
I can't. Oh, yeah.
you keep that under wraps?
No.
You're hiding? No.
We literally just met.
Yeah. You're not going to do it right away?
I was on the phone when you came
out,
and I was like, this is not the way. I was actually real excited to meet you.
Yeah.
And then I thought you were making a good joke. You're like, what's in that one?
No.
It was the last.
The guitar.
It's like shaped like a guitar. You're like, what's in that one?
You said a guitar. I was like... I was actually being more sort of like, you know, I'm trying to impress you. I'm like, what guitar is in there?
What's in that one?
Like, is that a J45?
A guitar.
Is that a...
That's some kind of 00 Martin.
Yeah? You folk like that one?
Festival Anniversary Edition.
Where'd you get
Philadelphia
that?
Philadelphia Folk Festival Anniversary Edition.
Really?
From Vintage Instruments in Philly.
So you grew up in Philly?
I grew up in Lansdowne, which is like the suburb directly... outside of West Philly.
Yeah, that's, and you can't leave the place. You love the place.
I do. In fact, not only that, but we moved in 2003.
Yeah.
We moved to Northern Liberties, and everybody's in, like, Fishtown. First it was Northern Liberties, and then they moved up to Fishtown. But
who's everybody?
Everybody in my relatively small...
Circle
of, like, music/artist community that I...
Oh, yeah? They moved up to where?
Fishtown and stuff. But anyway, I've moved since then, but I still have my little house in Northern Liberties, and I go in there and work. And now I live out in Mount Airy.
Mount Airy?
Yeah.
Where's that?
It's like Germantown. Yeah. It's a Germantown, then there's Mount Airy, then there's Chestnut Hill, and I'm on West Mount Airy. There's like woods out there. There's a, you know, parking is pretty bad in Northern Liberties, so
yeah.
I have a driveway. I live next to the woods.
That's nice.
Yeah, I got kids, so, you know, we got to be able to park.
It's how many kids?
Two.
Yeah? How old are they?
They are 8 and 5 going on 6.
So you're kind
two
of...
girls.
That's nice, and you've been married a long time?
Yeah.
And it's just, like, locked in. You're kind of a family guy.
Yep, just like the TV show.
Yeah.
Just like the cartoon.
I hope that not exactly like that.
No. I meant to tell you, I'm one of my best... buddies that I admire is your friend Tom Sharpling.
I was just going to bring him up.
Oh, did you know? Okay.
Well, no, I see he likes you too. Like, you guys are pals?
Yeah, I mean, we're past that. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's great. He's so funny. He's going to be in town this week.
Yeah, we're missing each other like that. It'd be fun to see him out here. Him and I did see one of his other buddies recently on the stage.
Who's that?
Andy Kindler.
Andy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just saw him on stage too.
I got a lot of, like, yeah, that's why I love the Tom thing. I admire him, and he's my buddy, and, like, it's, like, the ultimate platform. Not unlike this, but I know him well.
Yeah.
So you can just be as stupid as possible and just keep talking, and to have a friend to give you that.
Yeah.
And he just bullshits right back.
Oh, yeah. He's so fucking funny, man.
Yeah.
How'd you meet him?
I met him, I heard him first on those... the Gorsh, you know, like all his old calls with John Worster.
Yeah.
And then my band, Kurt Vile and the Violators, we opened, like, my first Matador, my album came out on Matador, Childish Prodigy, in 2009. And then I was offered to open for Big Star at like the Masonic Temple, and it ended up being Big Star's last show ever, which is crazy.
Wow, but like Big Star, like original lineup. Big Star?
Yeah. And then like a year later, he died. But anyway, Tom was there.
Yeah.
And somebody pointed out that Tom was there, so me and my bandmate Adam.
Yeah.
He was in my band.
How do you say his last name? Adams.
Oh well, Granduciel is his like stage
Granduciel,
name.
Granduciel. Yeah. That's his stage name.
I don't mean to say it's a stage name. He uses that, but it's not
his real name.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah. Me and him, we got obsessed with all his calls and
yeah.
He's like, we would just impersonate the hell out of it, and I was chasing him around. We were drunk, and he was like looking at us back, you know, walking away.
What do you want?
He was like, thank
me.
You. I'm very flattered. Thank you. Just impersonating everything, but he thought for sure we were making fun of him.
Yeah,
because that's kind of what. That's good. Just kind of what I like to do is just impersonate. Not like, here's my impersonation. Like just
right. But just a natural mimic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you guys become friends after that?
Definitely.
Yeah. And you do a show? You used to do a show?
I've been on a show multiple times. I can't wait to go back. He directed my KV Crimes video a couple albums ago.
Uh-huh. Which album?
Waking on a Pretty Day.
That's a good record.
Thanks.
Yeah, I listened to, like, I went all the way back today. Like, I think I have the last three albums or four albums, and I went and listened to Constant Hitmaker. So let's go back to, so when did you start with the music? You grew up in this, in outside of Philly, and you come from a musical family?
Yeah, we are a musical family. A lot of people play.
How many people in the family?
Actually, I'm one of 10 children. So I have 9 siblings.
Do you know them all?
Yeah. Oh yeah, because they're all from the same. They're all from the same parents.
Yeah. I know.
What's in that one?
but like that. Where do you come in the?
I'm
lineup?
The oldest son.
Uh huh.
I have 2 older sisters, but it's an even split. It's 5 boys and 5 girls.
That's crazy. It's like it's a lot of kids, man.
I know.
Was that like? Is that a Catholic thing or?
They're not Catholic, but they're like religious, you know.
Yeah, like what like, strand?
Like some kind of Christian strand, I guess.
Oh yeah,
I mean I don't know. I think they don't have like a
no. But was it like are you like, off the grid people? Are you living in a farmhouse?
I mean, what? No, we lived in Lansdowne. We lived in a twin house. You know,
kids?
All the boys in one room, 2 bunk beds.
Yeah, and the girls in the other room, and you just.
It was tight.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fights, and like we're all with nobody, you know, no hard feelings. And in fact, the one that I didn't get along with the most, I see him the most now.
Oh yeah, younger brother.
Yeah, my brother Paul. I haven't seen him lately, but he's you know, he's a character.
Yeah, Philly character.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. There is a specific thing. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's like a specific thing that happens in Philly and in Jersey. It's a certain type of dude that only happens in those two places.
Yeah, well, I'm just so glad because all these people now, you know, fleeing New York.
Yeah.
Defeated. I never had to go there to begin with, but I could still benefit from its resources. You know, I go up to New York and get the hell out of there. Now I have 2 houses.
Yeah. You did all right. You did all right.
Yeah.
It's going good. So how many people in the family played? Like, what was the instruments?
Just mainly guitar. Yeah. A little piano. Mainly guitars.
Yeah.
Banjos. Actually, banjos.
Oh, banjos, guitars. Yeah. Like, was your dad or mom musical people?
They're both like musical. My dad plays a violin a little. He picked it up later in life, but they're very encouraging and they're musical. It's like in their blood.
Yeah.
They're obsessive. Like my dad's obsessed with bluegrass.
Oh, really?
So that's where the banjo thing comes from.
He was hoping you'd
bluegrass in old time. Yeah. He was definitely hoping, I would
lock in.
Yeah.
Be a bluegrass player.
I guess, but he does. Yeah. His favorite song of mine is I'm an Outlaw, which is on my previous album. Well, the one that's out at the moment.
Yeah. He likes that one?
Yeah, because it's got the banjo. You
got
know?
A country tinge to it?
I guess. He just likes it that it's the banjo, you know? I wanted a guitar maybe when I was 13, and they were going to get, they're going to surprise me for one, with one for like my birthday or Christmas. Or, but then I was being particularly bad that year, or so they said. So, but then they, not only that, they were like, we were going to surprise you with a guitar, but you've been so bad, you're not getting it. So anyway,
yeah.
The next year, he's like, oh, how about banjo? And then at first I was like, I don't know, banjo.
Yeah.
And then I had a cousin who played music, and he encouraged me. He's like, oh, that's pretty unique. And yeah. I was like, all right. And then, but really, what really sold me is my dad drove SEPTA trains. You know SEPTA?
Yeah.
Are you from, where are you from? Are you East Coast?
I'm originally from Jersey, but I grew up in New Mexico. So he drove, I don't
okay,
know.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
He just had one of his conductor friends who he was going to buy the banjo off of play it over the phone, the telephone, you know, yeah. not the cell phone. And it sounded so cool going through that phone. He's like, oh, all yeah. right, here's a little...
He held it up to so you could hear
yeah,
it?
Yeah, he's like, here, how's it going? I'm going to play this song. I just played some kind of, I wish I remember the song, maybe Cripple Creek or something.
Uh-huh.
Who knows? It could yeah. be anything.
Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
It's something, one of yeah. those like... Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Yeah.
Great song.
Yeah, great, yeah. So he plays it over the phone and that sounded appealing.
Yeah, and so then I got it for my 14th birthday.
Five stringer?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. That tuned to an open what?
Open G, usually. That's yeah. right. Yeah.
Did you take to it?
Yeah, I took to it. That wasn't even my first instrument. Like, in elementary school, I played the trumpet in school. So I could always pick up the instruments pretty quick.
Yeah. Trumpet's a good one.
Yeah, I pick it up nostalgically sometimes and just blow a few notes in it, but I'm definitely not like fluent in it. And plus, you know, with the trumpet, you got to have the embouchure.
What's that?
It's like that word. It has to do with the way you... I don't even know for sure. But I know it from like the Miles Davis book, but everybody uses that word with trumpet. You're like, oh, you got to get your embouchure back.
Oh, like the stream of air into it?
Maybe that or just the... I don't even know.
Yeah.
Is it like the way you put your mouth into it? I actually don't really know.
Yeah, but you might as well throw the word around. Why not?
Yeah. You know, usually people know what it means, and they don't ask me what it means.
I'm sorry, I called you on it. I apologize. I just was curious. Now I'm going to have to look it up later. I hope you get it back, whatever it is.
I will. Good. Once I look it up.
So banjo's a pretty hard instrument to integrate into rock and roll.
Well, I guess, but I would say that...
You only did it on that one song?
No, I've played it a bunch. I do play it. Even my wife, she likes when I get into the banjo again because it's got that ethereal thing. It's like got the high drone string, so when you finger pick, you don't even have to hardly use any fingers.
Yeah.
I mean, on the fret hand.
Yeah.
And you just play these cyclical...
Oh, yeah, it's got a
kind
nice,
of finger picking.
Almost like a sitar.
Ethereal thing. Yeah, yeah. That it just puts you in the zone.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then also starting with the banjo, I did take lessons, and I would have otherwise gotten a guitar and they would have taught me like standard tuning,
mm-hmm.
play these bar chords.
Sure.
And because I started like with the open tuning.
Yeah.
It kind of like, in the world that I grew up in, all of a sudden, you know, like sort of indie rock type of bands and Sonic Youth or whoever, they're using like various tunings. And
yeah.
That was nothing new to me because, you know.
Banjo guy.
With banjo.
Yeah.
Banjo guy.
Yeah. Not surprising me with that open tuning. I'm a banjo guy.
Yeah.
Well, I it's weird because I have this weird thing with the Gallows Pole, you know, the Led Zeppelin song.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a banjo in there. And like I've often thought that it would be better without it.
Well, that's the dude. Yeah, when you add a banjo but play it in a rock setting, but still play like everybody's yeah. like that's corny.
All right, so you're playing banjo, and do you I play guitar with my brother? Do you have brothers playing guitar? Did you guys do family stuff? Did you jam together?
We jammed a little. Then I would just jam with my friends.
When was the first band?
Pretty soon after. 15, 16,
yeah.
I can't, somewhere maybe closer to 16,
yeah.
But I had a friend that I mean, I basically a year later, somebody gave me a neighbor across the street gave me a guitar because they always heard me playing the banjo.
So. And they were like, enough already.
No, they just, they probably thought it was a guitar. They're like, oh, I see you like guitar. Here's another guitar.
Really?
No, no. They must have known.
You
but,
live next door to leprechauns?
But they were, yeah. No. Yeah.
Here's your guitar.
No, actually, they were very nice. They were nothing like that.
Yeah.
They were just supportive, you know.
Yeah, it's nice.
Because we were always on the, like the porch playing, but like, not even an open porch. Yeah.
one of nine kids out there. So I guess at some point there was a kid somewhere outside all the time.
Yeah.
There's two of them.
I'm still nostalgic. I think about that because I never, all you could really do is play in your driveway or just all across everybody else's front lawns. Or
right,
back,
or in the street.
And, yeah, which that doesn't fly today, you know.
Yeah.
But I am nostalgic about driveways. I still don't have the right driveway in my house.
Do you have a good driveway? You don't like your driveway?
No.
What's the matter with it?
It just goes, it's like goes downhill. It's not the right, you can't run up and down, ride your bike. I can't ride my tricycle on it.
Can't ride your kid's bike.
I can't ride my big wheel on it.
Or my driveway?
Or my...
Too big of an angle?
Yeah.
Sorry, man.
It's all right.
Is there any way to make it a driveway that you like?
No.
Oh.
It's all right. That was so random. That's kind of how I talk sometimes.
No, there's no problem. Yeah. I mean, I know the feeling. I had to replace a driveway in my old house. This driveway is all fucked up, but this would be a good driveway if I put cement on it.
Does it go straight back?
It goes straight right out from the front to the street.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Did your driveway have a basketball hoop on it on the garage?
No, but neighbors did.
Oh, so you just go across the street?
I had a next door neighbor and he was my age.
Yeah.
We would just ride. He had like one of those. What's the show? What's the show with Waylon Jennings song? The Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh,
he had the Dukes of Hazzard bike.
Oh, really?
Like the car.
Yeah.
And I just had a regular big wheel, but we'd go back and forth all day.
The good old days.
Yeah.
The stuff you did at first was all sort of self-generated, right? A lot of it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't. Are you talking about the first CD?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, by the time that first CD came out, I don't know, let's see. Those are mostly my home recordings. The very first song, Freeway, was recorded by Brian McTeer, this guy in Philly. That was like my first studio recording, I guess.
Yeah.
But when I was like 20 to 21, like 21 to 23, I lived for 2 years basically in Boston. And out there I got one of those Roland digital 8-tracks and... I was working this crappy job so I could...
Where?
It was like an air freight company, Eagle Air Freight, driving a forklift. It was like a really...
Eagle Air Freight. Wait, how'd you end up in Boston?
Because my wife, my girlfriend at the time, she was like getting her master's.
Oh.
Anyway, so...
Driving a forklift.
Yeah, it was brutal.
With dreams. The worst.
Oh yeah, and they preyed on me instantly, like the lifers, like you ever see like you saw The Departed or something, you know that accent, but they're just like, "Yo, flamer,
flamer,"
yeah, he's like,
he calls you like a flaming,
yeah, "You fucking flamer," all the time, like he's like, "What's the name of your record label?" Bonehead Records, you know, like, and I'm like 20, like in a like literal blue suit.
Oh my god!
I didn't even mean to go back so far, but in that time, I was alone a lot, or you know, with my thing, and I was buying a lot of gear, and so I was doing the home recording thing. But then by the time 2008, that's when Constant Hitmaker came out, and that's when I had like a collection of to choose from of all my best home recordings, and that's
so
so it is sort of like a greatest hits of stuff that.
So that's what Constant Hitmakers.
Yeah,
is.
It goes from 2003 to 2008.
So okay, so like just before that, then like so like when you're in Philly and you put the when do you meet Adam and start like doing that stuff?
I met Adam in 2003 when I moved back to Philly from Boston.
I
moved into Northern Liberties.
Oh yeah,
yeah, and. Yeah, we were buddies, and we played together. We definitely played together kind of right away, but it didn't get serious. Or we had a next wave of getting serious, and I'd say from 2005 to 2008, that's when all, you know, he would play with me a ton in my band. Or like, at first, it was just me and him kind of like a duo, and then I would play in the War on Drugs with him. And then eventually, like, the Violators evolved out of that, and so did the War on Drugs.
So those are two different directions, but it was the same, a few of the same crew?
Well, I would say, yeah, that whole thing. I mean, the Violators was definitely, like, there were set members in the band.
Yeah.
Like, four members that all have pivotal roles. That's kind of always the way the Violators were, and definitely, and me and Adam, but there were, we were just always playing music together, recording at his house. So,
yeah.
So whether it be end up on my thing or the War on Drugs, you know, it just depended. But
did you, you were on the first War on Drugs record?
I'm on the first War on Drugs record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it was, you sort of went your separate ways in a way?
Yeah, I mean, as glad I am that I was on that record and stuff, Adam always knew I was obsessed with my own thing, always. And
yeah.
So I got to go to Europe for the first time through
with
the War on Drugs.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm stoked to do this, but you have to let me open. So I opened.
You did?
Yeah. But like, you know, I convinced Adam, you know, after he wasn't as busy with the War on Drugs, I'm very grateful because he played on my Smoke Ring record and he toured, and the Childish Prodigy, the first Matador record he played on. Like, that's all Violators.
Yeah.
You know, Adam, Jesse, my old drummer, Mike Zhang. So anyway, like, I'm just grateful that I got Adam to continue to tour in the Violators a little longer, because otherwise, I don't know what I would have done. He was really, he was really in the pocket.
Yeah.
He was really a pivotal member of the band. And
helped you define yourself too, I guess, probably.
Yeah, I think we both, you know, helped each other out.
And you guys still friends?
Yeah, definitely.
Is he around Philly too still?
I think he bought a place in Philly, but he's not there that often.
It's interesting. There are guys that play, like the War on Drugs too, but you as well. You know, there are guys that play and they never really find their own groove, but you have your own thing, you know, like you listen to it and it's sort of like, oh yeah, it's Kurt Vile. There's no denying ever, you know, there's no question about it.
That's right.
but it's not easy. It's not everybody has that.
Well, I'm also lucky that, imagine if, well, it's not like you heard it, but I'm glad I had time to like figure it out, because like that first Constant Hitmaker, I put out tons of CDRs before then, and they're fine. I mean, there's moments on them, but like it took me a while. I didn't have anything come out on a real label until I was 28, 29, so I had the time to fine tune my sound, and almost think I was never going to make it or something, you know?
Well, I mean, when you say CDRs, like how, let me go back again just for a minute. When you get your first guitar and then you're still hanging out at home and stuff, like how are you finding, you know, you're in the suburbs of Philly, but yeah, I mean, you're younger than me. What are you, like 39 or something?
I'm 38. Yeah, I'll be 39 in January.
So what kind of musical sources are you drawing from? Where are you getting your musical education?
Well,
you know what I mean? I'm not talking about playing. I'm just talking about what informs your taste.
I mean, I've always been pretty obsessive, so I got obsessed with most bands. You know, like, you know, I loved the Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah.
I probably wrote them off later or something, you know, a little or something. Like, I'm like, no, this is the new sound. Different classic things that my dad played, like Creedence, I loved right away. Things I loved right away. You know, Hendrix I loved as a kid. I had those early CDs.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, my early CDs were like a collection of Jimi Hendrix or something.
Yeah.
But then, you know, once like all these sort of more indie rock type of bands, the good ones, like, you know, anywhere from Pavement, Sonic Youth, Dinosaur Jr., you know, and a lot of Drag City.
Yeah.
Tons of the Drag City stuff.
You like the Drag City stuff.
Yeah. Palace Brothers, Silver Jews. I mean, David Berman's definitely a hero.
He's so great. He's so good.
Have
you hung out with him?
I have. I've
It's
I've
a lot,
managed
right?
to pull him out.
Yeah?
It took me a few times to get through to him. And finally, I remember one day I called him while I was in town for a gig.
In Nashville?
And he actually, I think that was the last test, because I called him. He didn't answer, or maybe he even answered and hung up, but then he showed up at the gig.
Oh, that's nice. I don't know what he's up to now.
He's doing stuff. He's gonna come back and break everybody's heart again.
Yeah. Drag City, yeah. Like, do you like the Bonnie Prince Billy
stuff?
Yeah,
I loved especially, like, Palace I grew up on. I, yeah. I, you know, I, yeah, definitely I've I like the Bonnie Prince Billy stuff too, but I guess I'm nostalgic. I was getting those 7 inches and the early records as they were coming out.
Oh, right.
But yeah, I like all versions of that.
Yeah, who else is on there? Joanna
Newsom. Bill
Callahan,
Smunk.
Callahan, yeah.
I mean, sure, I love actually Joanna Newsom's newest record. That record's incredible. I don't know if you've heard
the last one or is there
Divers?
One? Yeah.
That great. One's really good. Yeah. But I she came a little later, so I didn't. That wasn't my teens growing up on that stuff.
So Drag City was the hip sort of like this is new shit, cutting edge shit.
Like, yeah, but weird and accessible.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So that, you know, nobody was playing too hot of licks that they were unreachable or something.
Right. Seemed hey, that sounds like the guy next door.
Yeah.
Or like he's just playing in his room. That guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it seemed possible.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's important to have that. So that was sort of your template. Like, you know, I can do this and I can do it myself if I have to.
Right. And and I had friends, I was friends, to this day, I'm really good friends with a group who, they had a band and then their brothers. The youngest, my friend was Dan, you know, Dan Park. And then there's these two older Park brothers and they would record their brother's band, but then at different times, first it was Bob, then it was Dave. They would record my stuff. So like, you know, the whole home recording or semi-studio recording, I was doing it pretty early. I wasn't doing it myself. I would record on a tape recorder in my room, but I was in the quote-unquote studio since I was a teen.
Right.
And I'd put out a CDR and be like, call it my album.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, my next album is going to... It's not really an album. You know?
But what did you do with the CDRs? Like, how did you...
I would give them out to people. I became known, you know,
as the CDR guy.
I have one tape. I was, you know, as a teen I would play like this Marple Newtown coffee house, and I was like the star of that
scene.
Stupid. I was the star of that scene.
Yeah. Like just you and your guitar?
Yeah, with my tape.
Yeah.
More I meant to say with my stupid tape, you know.
Your album, your tape of your album?
Yeah, my next album is going to be killer.
You still got any of those tapes? Who's got the tapes?
I got them.
Did you go get like hundreds of them ran off?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you still got a box?
Yeah. I actually still have a box of the covers and the cases, because we accidentally got too many of those.
Yeah, but it's so, Phil, you have them. Yeah. It's so funny when you self-produce stuff. Man,
you must have some tapes or some CDRs.
Some CDs that I made, like that I ordered from the guy, you know what I mean? Like you design a cover. I didn't even get the gem box, you know, I just got the envelope. You know, like for the CD.
Yeah.
And made a cover design that I couldn't even use. And there's like a few hundred of those in my storage space.
Well,
I threw them away.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, luckily at the very end, like my last few CDRs, say seven of them, when I actually started, in 2003, I started just using my regular name, Kurt Vile.
Yeah.
And those, I have like a good handful of maybe seven different non-albums, let's call them, but they're pretty cool because I would go to Kinko's and get the nice hard paper and print it out like it's a vinyl. Then you fold it and you put it in the plastic thing, except it's a little CD.
Yeah.
And it made them look really cool. Like,
right.
Like a collage or whatever.
Yeah.
And I will say, I don't know how I guess they just use Bandcamp. It's just a different time. So maybe, but still, nowadays people just send you a link of their stuff, and I hate links.
Yeah.
At least I could just hand people something, you know?
No, it's nice. It was tactile. It was a different time, you know what I mean? Like, everything became part of the creative process.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to just, like, a link.
I hate links.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, you know, like when somebody hands you a tape where they made the cover and they packed it themselves, or even a record, because
I mean, you got records on the wall. You know, that's what people like. They like
All your records are nice. They open them up. And, you know, there's stuff, good pictures, you know, words and things, you know, like it seems early on some of the really early stuff, there was a lot more psychedelic weirdness going on. Is that possible?
In what ones?
Like
the early ones?
Yeah.
Well, that's because like, think about it. I'm no professional recorder.
Yeah.
So like the more effects you can put on something and add some analog synth weirdness, like the cooler it'll sound. Otherwise, it's just like you know, direct into some digital machine, it's not going to sound very good.
Right. Oh, so you had to hide the fact that
I think that's part of the reason, but that was also just into the psychedelic.
Yeah. The sound. You want to push the edge. You get the noise. Get the noise going.
Yeah. I'm nostalgic about that. I'm trying to get back to those roots.
Because it seems like you got pretty confident in terms of like how you produce your voice. Your voice is really sort of up front now, and you can like, you know, hear it, and you can hear the words, and you talk. And
yeah, that's true. There was definitely a lot of delay on the vocals in the old days.
Right. you sound like you're in some sort of a storage container.
Yeah.
So what was the when he stopped doing the hands up, the kind of homemade shit, that like, what's the process of recording now? Like, you got guys that you've been with forever?
Well, I have a bunch of guys that I like to work with.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever, who knows? I don't know if I'll find this producer ever again and be like,
Which guy?
No, like, I'm just saying, like,
yeah.
Like, just work with one person, like, maybe, but I doubt. Now I work with, like, multiple people. Rob Schnapp is a guy I work with in L.A.
Yeah.
And I really like to work with him. He's, like, got a great ear, and, like, some of my poppiest jams, like Pretty Pimpin', he did. And some of my favorites on this record, he did. And then there's a guy on the East Coast, Peter Kadis. I recorded with him with the Violators. He did like Interpol and all that stuff. Obviously, we're nothing like that, but he's an engineer whiz as well.
Yeah.
He rescued my last record, I'm Going Down, because we ran out of time. We had to mix it. It was due. And he finished mixing like a ton of songs and made them sound great in like just a few days.
Yeah.
So then on this record, I went back with the band and had him record some of the songs, and then yeah,
because he saved the songs. He's like, this guy.
Well, I was like, well, he saved the record. Maybe he can save the band. But turns out, you know, no one person can save the band.
Can save a band.
Yeah,
it takes a band to save a band.
Yeah.
Tell me about like the last album or the one before. I believe I'm Going Down.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, it's like sort of a blues trope.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you a blues guy?
Well, yeah, I actually forget to mention the blues lately because I get into anything, I get so deep into it that people ask me again and it's on my new trip. But yeah, like Delta Blues, Charlie Patton, Mississippi
Patton.
John Hurt.
Yeah. That lick that Hurt does, that little bend that, Yeah.
I mean, those are the obvious ones, and there's tons.
Yeah. Fred McDowell?
Yeah, love. Oof. Fred McDowell.
Crazy. So, like, that's a recent one for you? That's recent stuff? Like,
what?
Like getting into that?
No, I got into that. I got heavy into that, I'd say, starting when I was in Boston, like, in 2000, 2001.
The forklift era?
Yeah, but it was only an extension of... I made some cool friends out there in Boston, yeah. Like, who were actually going to college when I should be.
Right.
Except I was, like, the dude, the kind of shy, weird guy,
yeah,
who would... have to get up early and drive the forklift when he's hanging out with these college kids,
yeah,
that are like smoking weed and like listening to Brian Eno. And this kid turned me on to John Fahey. You know, obviously he's John Fahey.
Yeah.
Like, he's like a student of the people, like Charlie, he wrote a book about Charlie Patton in college or whatever. But anyway, I remember I saw that this kid had the American Folk Anthology, and I was like, oh, my dad has that. And my dad was playing like Bull Weevil and all that
Bull
stuff.
Bull Weevil Blues?
And then I was like, oh, well, I guess it's cool, you know. And I grew up on like Doc Watson and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But then my dad was...
Bluegrass.
Yeah. So then I remember I went home on a break, and I went to like the Bluegrass Festival with my dad, and
yeah,
I bought all these CDs, like all these blues, tons of blues CDs. I just got deep into all that stuff.
It's good, right? Like
of course. Well, I mean, it informs everything as well.
Fahey, I think he and a couple other guys went and found Skip James.
Yeah. There's a chapter about that in his book.
Oh, yeah?
How Bluegrass Music Destroyed My Life.
Oh, is that what that's the name of the Fahey book?
The Fahey book, yeah.
Did you have a record store that you went to when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I had a CD store.
Yeah.
At first, I went to CRCDs, but yeah, then I would go into town to get like 7 inches. And once I realized that there was stuff you couldn't get, like that wasn't on the stuff on vinyl, yeah, you know, like exclusive right. stuff on vinyl. Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, in the you 90s, I would go into town and go to Philadelphia Record Exchange.
Oh, yeah? Oh, is that a famous place?
It's famous among, you know.
You guys?
It should be, maybe it should be more famous, but right then it was on South Street. And, yeah, like people come, like there's a, the owner, JC, he's from that band, the Strapping Field Hands. I don't know if you ever heard of him, them or the Silt Breeze label, like all those early Dead Sea records.
No, I don't know anything about them. What kind of music?
Seems like you, it's like weird, lo-fi.
Yeah.
Well, the Dead Sea's from New Zealand. It's like a, they're a Flying Nun band.
Oh yeah, the Flying Nun. I got some of that stuff. That's pretty stuff.
It's pretty noisy stuff.
Really? Some of the Flying Nun stuff.
Oh, this Flying Nun. I thought we were still talking about the Dead Sea, sorry.
But you said that, but they're a Flying Nun band or they're not?
They were.
Oh.
Yeah.
Too noisy for Flying Nun? They kicked them off?
No. they were.
Yeah. But so this guy had his own label and he ran the place.
Well, got another guy, Tom Lax. He had the Silt Breeze label and he worked at the Record Exchange at one point or all kinds of.
So it's interesting though. So it's a place that had definitely, it was a curated situation because you had guys with points of view about music and it was like one of those classic record stores where you go in and they'd lay down some wisdom, right?
Yeah. Totally. And you're like, oh, you know. Yeah, I found like all the early Drag City Pavement.
Yeah.
EPs before it was too hard to find them or something.
Oh, he had them? They had them down there?
They had them there.
Yeah, so like it's always good to, like, so you're like 20 when you're going in there, 18?
18. So 17, 18.
A young mind.
Yeah.
These old
young
bitter,
suburban mind.
These old bitter record guys with their labels.
Yeah.
Dumping stuff in your head.
Yeah, like, I mean, how's this record? You know, all young and impressionable. They shoot you right down.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but
not as good as the first one, which you can't get anymore.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
No, but they're cool. I still know that I still go see them to this day.
Yeah?
Yeah, great guys.
What do you think that you learned the most? Like, what do you think really blew your mind like from those guys? Like, what changed your thinking like in dealing with the... Because I'm always curious about the dudes that turn people on to things. Like, I know who my guys
well,
were.
Well, I'll tell you later on.
Yeah.
The one guy they call Harmonica Dan because he's always jamming harmonica with different sets. Like, in fact, were you ever into Jack Rose, by the way, speaking of John Fahey?
He's Jack Rose.
He passed away, but he was an incredible guitar player.
I don't know him.
The John Fahey torch. He's from Philly. Okay.
Great.
You should, yeah, you got it.
I'll write that down, too.
But anyway, one time this is after they knew who I was and, you know.
Yeah.
He gave me a Randy Newman record. He was like, I got that. I put that aside for you. And I was like, really? Randy Newman?
Mm-hmm.
And
which one?
It was the one with Short People. And that's all I knew. I was like, Short People?
But, Little Criminals?
But, yeah. But then, you know, Baltimore, that song blew my mind. And then, you know, a little later, I got Sail Away. And it just destroyed me. And I would burn these things onto CDR, you know, and just take them on the road with me. And, you know, when you realize that song Sail Away, which is it's about, you know, getting, slavery, like you don't even realize it. You're just like, oh, I don't know, like his lyrics, he'll destroy you. You know?
I interviewed him. It was one of the best days of my life.
That's amazing.
Oh, I love the guy.
Good old boys.
The best.
He's like, yes, baby, I've been drinking.
That's the best song in the world.
It just comes down to, he's like, you know, I can't stand myself.
Yeah.
It takes a whole lot of medicine for me to pretend that I'm somebody else.
The best, dude. That's like, I just got chills. That song kills me, man. I met him and we interviewed, I'm a huge fan. So I interviewed him and then I told him I wanted to hang out sometime. So we went to this event where he was playing and I ended up emceeing it, but it was for Flea. It's a long story. It's at Flea's Conservatory.
Uh-huh.
Where, you know, he has a school that teaches kids and it's a fundraiser and Randy Newman was headlining and I asked him to play Guilty and he fucking played it.
Oh, man.
What a tight song though, right?
Yeah, and I did a cover of one of his later songs.
Which one?
Pretty Boy.
Oh.
It's like from the album where he's mocking Kiss on the cover.
Yeah, yeah, Money. Like, the Money.
We got a tough guy here. We got a tough guy from the streets.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, looks just like that dancing wop from those movies that we've seen. You know that one?
No.
He's like, with his cute little chicken shit boots on. You know, he just, yeah. Oh, man, he ripped.
What's that album called? Born Again or something, or yeah. something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, oh, I wonder if I have that one. I'm real hung up on that first four records.
Well, you got that one's got, and I heard from somebody who
it's got it's Money That I Love, right, is on there. It's Money That I
yeah, Love. It's yeah. Money That I Love.
Yeah.
Or yeah, or yeah. like Hey Little Sheep.
Yeah, you know, yeah, yeah.
Something about Little Sheep.
He's cutting, man. Such yeah. a sweet guy. Very self-effacing. Very you know, yeah. Like hard on himself.
I saw him once, and I've been a fan forever. And we played Harley Strictly Bluegrass Festival, the same stage.
Yeah.
And I just didn't even talk to him because I just saw him there and I didn't know what to say. It was like I loved him so much that for once I couldn't even, where do you start? Same with like Neil Young.
Yeah.
Like I meet him multiple times just for a second, but like, how's he going to know?
Yeah.
How can you hold his attention, you know?
So you didn't say anything to Neil either?
No, I've said things to Neil many, every time.
You said things to him?
Oh, yeah. I have to.
Yeah, I'd like to see you guys talking to each other. He's kind of got an odd frequency too.
Yeah, I listened to your show.
Yeah, that's something, man. I didn't know how that was going to go.
I've gotten a couple funny interactions with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, the one time I met him, the first time was just cool. Yeah. So I'll blow through that.
Yeah.
But then the second time wasn't that long ago. He played, it was the first time I saw him with The Promise of the Real, and it was incredible, and it blew my mind. Like, they back him up so good, and I managed to get backstage, because I got on the list by, like, his day-to-day manager,
yeah.
Frank.
Okay.
Because Frank, he manages Hope Sandoval from uh-huh. Mazzy Star, and, like, they got me to sing with her on a yeah. song, so anyway, that was my connection, but I still had to reach out and see if it would happen, and it happened that he got me on the list. And yeah. then he's like, "Oh, I'd love to meet," or something. I was like, "Oh, it's going to happen. It's going to happen." But then when it did finally happen, he just said hello for a minute after the show, and the show blew my mind. It was incredible. Like, they played Down by the River for 30 minutes, and it was just unreal.
Yeah.
He would start like as if he's going to the last verse after Space Jam, and he would just come in and be like, "Be on my side, wow!" And then he wouldn't sing the rest of it. You know, he'd just go into space again. He's
yeah.
just fucking with your mind.
Yeah.
But anyway, so finally get back there, and Frank, thank God for Frank. What a great guy. But still, I don't know him that well. He's like, "All right, well, thank you. It's great to meet you. Thank you for singing with Hope. Well, we have a quick out. We have to leave, but it was nice to meet you." Of course, my heart sinks. Yeah. I thought, I was like, it's going to happen. I'm going to meet Neil and blah, blah, blah. And I'm with my wife, Suzanne. And then we get back there. And I don't know. He's sitting there. So I finally get, Frank says, "Oh," he introduces me to the young guys, the Nelson guys that back him up.
Sure.
And
Willie's kids.
Yeah, Willie's kids.
Yeah.
So Neil is finally there, but nobody ever troubles Neil with anything, you know. So Suzanne just had to basically nudge me. She's like, "Just say something to him. Just say hi."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, Neil, I've seen you a million times. I'm friends with Gary. I gotta say, tonight was the best by far. Down by the River it was like you were in outer space but underground at the same time." And he smiled at first, and then he was like, he just looked at me. He's like, "Oh yeah, we can go in outer space whenever we want." I actually told that on the best show when it happened, because Tom Sharpling was there.
Yeah.
So we summed it up. But anyway, and then Suzanne was like, ask for a picture. And I didn't want to, because I was like, I heard he doesn't do pictures. And I was like, "Oh, can I get a picture?" He's like, "Sure." So I got a picture. But anyway, so then I met him a few times since then. I'm always like, it's always behind a stage. I'm always drunk. And I get like a little cynical, because I'm always saying the same thing. I'm like, "Oh, Kurt, I met before, friends Gary."
Yeah.
I always want to tell him about this band. You ever see this band, the Sadies?
No.
They're an incredible live band. They're legends.
Yeah.
They're friends with Neil. Like, they're two brothers. They shred. You got to see them live. They're like country infused rock, psychedelic rock. And so I always mean to tell Neil, because I know he likes the Sadies. I'm always like, mean to say, "I'm friends with the Sadies," but I always forget. But then the last time we opened for Neil, just recently in Quebec, like not a couple weeks ago even.
Oh, yeah?
And it was like for this big festival. So there's like 90,000 people there. It's just us and Neil. And
oh, that must have been great.
It was great. I definitely clammed up.
Yeah. On stage?
Yeah, I clammed up. I never played for a crowd that big. Like I started with that song Wheelhouse, and which is a favorite song, but I just like flubbed one of the notes, and then I lost it, you know. But anyway, so Neil,
he fucked you up for the whole set.
Most of it. Yeah. So I just stood there. Okay. I mean, I played, but I stood there. But anyway, Neil, they played an amazing set as usual, and we got to watch it from side stage, and then, we were on the one side of the stage, and the other side of the stage is where they would get on and off. And so during the encore, and I mean, I know a lot of the guys now. I know the Promise of the Real guys. I've played with them at Willie's Ranch, so I'm buddies a little bit with plenty of them, but not Neil. But so anyway, they go off for the encore, and they're all passing around this joint.
Yeah.
And then I ran with my wife, and we got the joint, and we started smoking it. So we're like, Neil hit it, but so we're smoking that joint, and then finally the same thing sort of happens. They all come off the stage. I'm hugging like Lucas and everybody, and they're like, "Great show," but Neil has this orb around him. You're like, he can't get in. Daryl Hannah is there with a giant lollipop, like hugging Neil. Everybody's like around Neil's, and so they're going down the exit in the back like a zigzag, you know?
Yeah.
And he gets a little further away every time, and finally, because we're like a little stoned, I'm like, "Well, I just won't talk to him," you know? And then she's like, "Well, just I was like, I just wanted to give him this Sadie CD, and then she's like, "Well, just jump down and give it to him because it's the last level." We were like on this level and they're down there right before he gets on the bus. So then I jumped down and I was like, "Hey Neil," I was like, "Hey Neil, you hear the new Sadies?" And I knew he knew him, but the way I did it, because we were stoned, it looked like this dude came out of nowhere, yeah. And it was like Elliot Roberts literally held up his elbow like to block me.
Yeah,
he was like, "Hey!" Everyone was like, "Whoa, whoa!" And I was like, "Oh, so, I don't know." Then I gave him the CD, and then I don't know. That's basically the story.
Was he into it? Or you don't
know?
He
was looking at it. They're his friends, but like everybody was blocked. I just came out of nowhere. I understand. But even I talked to Elliot. He's obviously a legend too. And I was like,
Elliot.
I was like, "Elliot." But I didn't even see that he blocked me with his arm. Suzanne watched. She was all up on the top level laughing.
Yeah.
We were all stoned on their weed and they're just laughing. And this old dude's like holding up their elbow like they're going to block me. And then all of a sudden, Elliot was like, "Oh." He's like, he looked all confused because then when we realized it was me, he's like, "Oh, Kurt, what the?" And he's like, "Just give it to me. He's not going to listen to it anyway," or something like that, which is not true.
Yeah.
Because he didn't know it was the Sadies. But then I said to Elliot, I was like, "Elliot, I'm Kurt. I just wanted to." And he's like, "The Sadies, I know." He just didn't know who you were. He didn't know who you were.
Yeah.
I'm like, "Well, that's kind of the always sort of, maybe it's not the thing. Maybe most people just talk to somebody like a normal person."
It's always awkward.
But
it's always awkward, especially when you have reverence for somebody.
I think they're all, it's such an honor to have been able to get near and see so many shows and I just feel like they're like, "Oh, Kurt, you know, yeah, we know Kurt, he's a good kid, but you gotta watch him. He might steal your wallet.
He'll jump out of nowhere and scare you.
You gotta watch him. He's trying to talk to Neil."
Here he comes again. The kid's here. Yeah. Well, even when I talk to McCartney, like you get into the zone with it and you have the moment, but then when it's over, you're like, "I'm just like one of those guys. You know, I'm one of those guys."
But you're not. That's the thing, right? But you're also not.
You want them to know.
You want them to know.
How many people have opened for Neil Young? Like, you know, from the beginning of time. In my mind, it's like, I'm another guy who interviewed McCartney. Was it amazing for me? Am I grateful? Yes. Is it a different format? Yes. Is what I do different than other people? Sure. But in his life, you know what I mean? You, like, I don't know. You want to make an impression, but who knows if you do, really.
So he's a, well, that's why he's so great, is because he...
Who, Neil?
Yeah, he won't let... Yeah, well, yeah. Paul McCartney's great too, obviously, but I'm just... Like Neil, he just won't be bothered he'll just focus on his thing, and it's nothing personal. And in fact, one day, he'll just talk.
Yeah.
I mean, he was real cool on your show. I liked that show.
Yeah, once I sort of got through the gauntlet, you know, he was really cool.
Yeah.
But, like, he definitely tests people, and he definitely is going to, you know, make you work for it for a minute. But he's, like, an amazing artist. So, wait, let's talk about this new record before we space it out. So, but I also wanted to ask you about the John Cale thing.
That was at the end of the Courtney. I did this record with Courtney Barnett recently, yeah. And we did one tour, but at the very end of it, I ended up at, last minute got invited to play this John Cale Velvet Underground, what do you call it, anniversary.
Yeah.
And that was awesome. He's a trip.
Yeah.
I sat in on Big White Cloud and on guitar, and I got to sing and play on Run, Run, Run.
Oh, that's a great song.
And
Are you a Velvet guy?
Yeah, of course. that's just sort of like
the basics.
That's sort of, yeah, but that's also like when you're like, oh, you're a blues guy. Of course, I'm a Velvet Underground fan, but I like consumed that in my teens, you know.
Sure.
But it's still, of course.
Yeah. I still listen to it. So the new record, like in terms of like how you approached it, was it any different than the last one in terms of production and stuff? What are the big changes for you on this one? What made you go, I'm doing this different?
Basically, the biggest difference is that I would record in between tours or trips, just in normal life, like go record for a couple days here and then keep going, as opposed to like do some long album tour and start an album from scratch.
Yeah.
After all the touring is done, I can't stomach that anymore. It makes me want to vomit. So I just kind of like live it.
Yeah.
You know, I just go in and out of the studio, like while you're en route, like play a show.
Yeah.
And then you're in California and then you know, just go into the studio and don't stay in as long
for a week.
Knock out a couple
the whole
days.
Record. Yeah. A couple songs at a time.
Yeah, or even a song, but yeah. That, you know, so you got like a sort of travelogue of, it's just kind of just real life, you know.
Oh, so
that's where I'm at.
So it unfolded in sort of a real life way. Like each song, there was times between each song.
Yeah, and there's plenty of songs left over. Like I've just kind of been recording the whole time I've been on the road for the last record, really. Made that Courtney record with Courtney. I just made several records within. I've been recording kind of the whole time I made that Courtney record.
So this, like, in other words, the difference was you know you're sort of outliving life, and you drop into the studio, do a song, maybe two songs, and it was sort of like, were the songs being written when you came back to record one? Was it, did you already have it in the pocket, or you're sort
a lot
of like
a lot of times I'll get inspired. I have certain songs in the pocket for sure that I know I want to record, but a lot of times when I have a studio date coming up, I'll get inspired and write more songs. The newer the song in the studio, the better.
Well, it's a great record. It sounds like a Kurt Vile record, and it's like I thought it was great. Listening to him. I like it. You brought up the zone. It seems like you're very good at getting in the zone. That you create an atmosphere with your music, and it's relaxing, and it's sort of ethereal.
Oh, thanks, man.
Is that what you're shooting for?
I guess. It depends.
Well, it doesn't make me anxious, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, that's... I know, I can feel anxious. I got certain songs that are real chill, but they're about, like, being terrified on the airplane. I'm on the way to the studio, and I sort of think I'm going to die, so I write down these lyrics, and then all of a sudden it's like, stop this plane, because I want to get off. But I will say about the John Cale thing, the very last song, which is really long, it's called Skinny Mini, but there's, like, insane guitar solos. I wrote those lyrics while I was backstage waiting to go on for the John Cale.
Yeah.
I don't know. So that's sort of another example of just kind of...
Like how
just
you do it.
Kind of live it, you know. On the very last KV Courtney Barnett show in Austin, we had one last sound check, and I had this guitar jam, and then I just put it right into my looper, you know, and it stores loops. And then I went straight there from there to John Cale, and then it was just inspiring atmosphere. I had my own backstage room, and so I started playing the loop, and then I heard the song in my head, and then a few days later I was supposed to go into the studio again, so then I had this jam, you know.
Right. So that's what it did.
Yeah, that's what we started with.
Oh, that's right. So it's probably a better way to work, really, to stay open through the whole process just by living life.
Yeah, totally. And it's not like I was like, this is my theory.
No, right.
That's just the way it is. You know, this is my theory. Yeah. I'm going to.
Yeah. I'm going to tour, right? Go in the studio for one song and then tour and then do a John Cale event.
And perhaps backstage, I will write the lyrics.
It worked, though. It worked. Maybe it'll be your system. It's good talking to you, man.
Okay.
You good?
Yeah, if you are.
I am.
Okay, good.
That was cool, man. He's an interesting dude. He left his hat here. I had to send it back to him. What was that hat? I think it was a Waylon Jennings hat, in my recollection. It seemed important. Because if you have something as specific as a Waylon Jennings hat, you're going to want that hat back. I got it back to him. Kurt's new record, Bottle In, comes out this Friday, October 12th. You can get it wherever you get music. Don't forget to grab yourself a paperback copy of our book, Waiting for the Punch. It's out next Tuesday, October 16th, but you can pre-order your copy now at markmaronbook.com. Okay? You can do that. Okay? Or click on the book link at WTFpod.com. Right? You got it? No more waiting for the punch. I've been getting a lot of feedback for this echo pedal that Tal Wilkenfeld gave me. Everything is not okay, but it might be okay with you if you look around your life and your loved ones. It might be okay. That's the micro. Keep the macro in mind. All right? Vote it up. Boomer lives.